You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Autism is a group of complex disorders related to brain development. People with autism may have anxiety or struggle with small changes to routines. And this pandemic has been anything but a gradual change that could have been prepared for. So without the daily rhythms of school and work and familiar outings, this can be a very difficult time for families living with autism. Do you have a friend or sibling who has autism? What do you love about them? And how are you being a good friend to them in this difficult time? We're at 800-642-1234. Kristen Wegner is a clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona. She works with children and families performing diagnostic evaluations and functional behavioral assessments. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Kate.
So autism is complex, and no two people with autism are exactly the same. How would you best describe how it affects a child's social and behavioral skills?
You hit it right on the head. There is no two people that are the same. And autism affects both the social and behavior. And when we look at an infant or a young child, we would see that child fail to participate in baby games, in the so bigs and the patty cakes and the peekaboos. And as that child develops, that child might fail to communicate their wants and their needs. They might not use pointing or gestures or facial expressions, eye contact, to communicate what they want and need. They might pull their parent to an object or try to get the object themselves. And as that child continues to grow into preschool and school age, the social deficits make it very difficult to navigate social situations. They might fail to understand another person's perspective. They might fail to understand when somebody is trying to help them. They might think that instead of offering assistance, somebody is trying to take something from them. And then behaviorally, what we call restricted, repetitive behaviors can be extremely difficult to define because, as you said, one person with autism is one autistic person. And so some people, when they hear the word autism, they think of somebody who might be flapping their hands or rocking back and forth. And while that might be the case for one person, it's certainly not the truth for everyone. Repetitive behaviors can be lining up a toy or having a particular intense interest in an area or a specific toy or activity. And when that is disrupted, when the routine changes, they get a drink in a different colored cup or don't get to wear the clothes that they thought they were going to wear that day, it does cause anxiety and distress.
How have you seen this distress and anxiety in all of these upended routines? How have you seen that affect the autism community?
Oh, so different for every child and family. Some of the children that we had worked with who had been discharged and were being successful with the supports in the community and in schools, all of a sudden didn't have those supports anymore and didn't understand, you know, why doesn't my teacher like me anymore? Why can't I go to school? I'm not sick. And they just didn't understand what was happening. And I think all of us struggled with that, but it's so abstract because we don't look sick and they're not sick. And so they didn't understand why they couldn't go to school, why they couldn't see their friends, why they couldn't go to McDonald's. All of the daily routines were all of a sudden disrupted. And then to add, especially for the school age kids, a new distance learning paradigm and trying to navigate a social world that is difficult enough in three dimensions, now on a two-dimensional platform, and then without their supports from their occupational therapist or their speech therapist, their special ed teacher, or their paraprofessional, all of those supports were lacking. So it was extraordinarily difficult both in the school paradigm, but then also with home, because now many parents were working from home, and that wasn't usual. Dad's supposed to be at school, you know, work. I'm supposed to be here. Mom's supposed to be, you know, going to work, and all of that just caused significant disruption.
We're discussing autism with Kristen Wegner, who works with children and families in Altoona. She's a clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center. Taking your questions, are you a parent who has your child been diagnosed with autism? Have you been working on behavioral therapy? What has that like been you have done it remotely? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen, when the pandemic started, non-essential businesses closed, but your center was deemed essential. How did your facility operate during those stay-at-home days?
Right. Initially, we tried to continue offering our services in the same manner that we were, but that quickly changed as many of our families were working in situations where they had potential exposure to someone with the COVID-19, or if a child, and we have little kids, we have 2 and 3 and 4 year olds, and they're touching their noses and their eyes and somebody gets a cold, well, then you don't know whether or not that was possibly the coronavirus. So in March or so, we ended up shutting our doors for direct sessions and moved to the telehealth sessions for a month or so until we were able to get enough masks for our kids that are able to wear masks and for ourselves to get masks and more disinfecting equipment, and now have since reopened and are doing direct sessions and a combination of the telehealth.
What did you find in telehealth? What were some of the challenges with these virtual assessments and these virtual appointments?
And again, differing so much for every individual. For my littlest patients, those under 3, the telehealth was just not a conducive therapeutic tool. They are used to using their iPads and their tablets for entertainment. And so there were many times during the session, even though I was trying to be extraordinarily entertaining and fun, all of a sudden the iPad was upside down or the child was underneath the table, and the parents were fabulous in working. And that's really what we did with our telehealth, especially for the younger children, was have a parent meeting initially and work with our parents to assess what their needs were in that time, and then help the parents in coaching the parent to best meet the needs of that child. For the older children, for the school-age children, they were able to navigate that environment better. And so we're able to use that technology to provide a more similar type of therapy experience.
Yeah, when you're using tablets and other technology with children with autism, how are you using this technology?
Sure, we're using either the Zooms or the FaceTimes, the GoToMeetings, any of those types of platforms, and then we're setting up in one of our therapy rooms. And typically, what we would do is we would create a packet of materials that we would put outside the door and the parents would pick up. And so the child would have similar materials. And so if, for example, we are working with a child on identifying feature, function, or class, we might have a set of objects, they have a set of objects, and we would give clues and have back and forth exchanges with both of us having materials and
on both ends of that computer. Clinical psychologist Kristen Wegner is our guide as we spend the hour on autism and how to support families. You can join in. Are you a therapist working with children who have social or developmental disabilities? How have you been coping during the pandemic? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about living with autism during these turbulent times. It's an hour-long conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Routines, they've been out of whack for months now, and that's especially concerning for individuals living with autism. Learning to live with uncertainty, the increased anxiety, the inability to go to therapeutic sessions, this is all territory that the autism community is dealing with. Parents and caregivers, does your child have special needs or autism? What has it been like guiding them through this pandemic? How have you experienced the coronavirus? How have you explained the coronavirus to them? Do they understand? Join in 800-642-1234. Kristen Wegner is a clinical psychologist in Western Wisconsin, and she stays with us. So, Kristen, you know, it has been several months since the outbreak started. I'm sure children are hearing about the coronavirus. My kids are asking about it. How can a parent describe COVID-19 to help a child with autism or special needs understand?
Well, that is a loaded question. It's again, abstract. It's something we can't see. And I think many of us struggle with, why should I wear a mask? I'm not feeling sick. I don't have any symptoms. And the best way that we have tried to explain it is just that some people are sick. You're not sick. I'm not sick. But there are other people who are sick, and we need to do our job to make sure that we help them and we all stay safe. And so there certainly are activities or science experiments that you can do to help to give some concreteness of putting paint on your finger, pretending those are the germs and how we touch those, and then using washing our hands and how we can get that paint off or getting those germs away. And so trying to make it concrete would be one way to explain how and why we wash our hands. And then with the masks, just saying that, you know, there are people that are sick, and so we don't want to get sick, and we want everybody to stay safe, and so we're going to wear these masks to help everybody and do our job to keep people safe.
Yeah, and you know, schools, the kids abruptly stopped going to school back in March. There was a lot of confusion around that, and you know, some kids are really scared about entering their school again. They're worried that they may be susceptible to something they don't truly understand. And their school suddenly seems to be a little bit of a scarier place. How do you make it less so when everyone is wearing masks and being reminded not to touch each other?
Sure. I think that we can help build confidence and assurance in our children and in ourselves by knowing if we are doing what needs to be done, if we are washing our hands, if we are cleaning our desk and our table and our doors, that we are keeping the germs away. And then also being very reassuring to teach the children that our healthcare professionals are amazing. Our doctors know how to take care of us. Our doctors and nurses and care providers are helping those people that get sick, and that even though there is a virus, even though there is some sickness, we don't have to be afraid of it, just like we don't have to be afraid of the other things in the world that are scary. A car can hurt us, but we don't run out into the street because we know how to protect ourselves. And so if we put it into context with, there are scary things and the world can be a scary place, and we don't have to be afraid to venture out, just like we're not afraid to cross the street because we know how to protect ourselves. We know what to do to stay safe. And one of the things that we do in therapy is not to avoid situations that make us anxious or make us feel nervous. We need to embrace those situations and learn how to regulate our behavior, learn how to calm our bodies down, and do what we need to do to be able to be successful, whether that's facing a virus, whether that is facing a loud noise, a social crowd, whatever it is. Our goal is to help our children be able to feel that anxiety and feel that distress and then continue on and not stop doing what they need to do.
Yeah. Kristen Wegner with us, a clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Western Wisconsin. We're checking in on the autism community during the pandemic. Are you a teacher who works with children with autism? What was virtual distance learning like this spring? Did the kids enjoy it? Were you able to connect them with them? Where did you find success? And what were the challenges? What held you up? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen, let's look at how the distance learning went this spring with the individualized education plans, the IEPs. How were challenges as teachers who work with their children with autism? What were they faced with in trying to follow these plans in a distance model?
I'm chuckling because for us, and I would assume for most teachers, the biggest obstacle with the remote learning was the technology itself. Take autism aside, economically disadvantaged individuals don't have the same resources as those that have more affluence. And so there are some families whose internet connection is not nearly as strong as another family's who might be able to pay for a higher speed internet. And so some of our families, there were days, and I don't know if it has to do with the weather or what it has to do with, but there were days that we lost that connection 15 times in an hour. And that had to have been that poor child sitting there wanting to engage, and then the connection gets lost, and then they have to reconnect, or the screen freezes, and we're trying to, they can hear us, but they can't see. And so, first of all, just take that technology piece of it. I think for us, that was the most frustrating. We had a great lesson plan, we had a great therapeutic plan, and then our screen is frozen, and we can't now see. So that, I think, was number one. Then when we look at the autism piece, that was so difficult because of that understanding of the social aspect. Back and forth interactions are so difficult to navigate. And we use our hands and our faces and our gestures to help communicate what we are thinking and feeling. And even those are difficult for a person with autism, they still use that information. And when it becomes two-dimensional, that can be very difficult. For the IEP and the special education aspect, as I spoke earlier, so many of our students have a large support team. They have an OT, a PT, a speech person, a special education teacher who is adapting and modifying lessons for the child who is in the general education setting. So that child is in this inclusive classroom but is getting support from a large team. And now all of a sudden that team is broken up, each in their own home, trying to deliver a curriculum, some content. And I think that disjointed aspect was extraordinarily difficult for both the professionals to navigate but also for the students.
And for the parents who are now on the other end trying to not only help coordinate all of this, but perhaps for the first time spending a number of hours caring for their child and trying to deliver education, maybe while they're trying to work at the same time.
Oh, Kate, that is absolutely true. The parent became the case manager and was the one that was coordinating. And as you said, many of those parents were also working, and some working from home, but some essential care workers. So some were doctors or nurses or working in a nursing home or at the grocery store. And so they had to try to navigate, how do I get care for my child and coordinate this learning and continue to do my job. And it was extraordinarily, and still is, extraordinarily difficult for a family to navigate.
So the CDC has come out with more guidelines each day. And one of the things schools are looking at is how do they reopen in the fall? And there's been this talk about a hybrid model that maybe a four-day school week. For a child with autism, is that type of hybrid model a difficult thing?
It's really going to be difficult to say. I think one of the things we should look at is altering our paradigm. How do we look at supporting that child? And so, as I said earlier, we had children that had previously been discharged and were being successful, and we have since started providing therapy again in order to fill in some of those gaps. And fortunately, the funding sources are allowing us to supplement that child's therapy. So I think that by utilizing the resources in the therapeutic community and in the county, that we would be able to help support those areas that are missing.
Kristen Wegner, a clinical psychologist, she works with children who have autism. Are you a teacher who works on individualized learning plans for children with autism? What was virtual learning been like in the school year? What did you learn? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. On a Friday, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about autism, gathering advice for families navigating the social distancing and the cancellation of so many things that had become the rhythm of our lives. The latest estimates indicate 1 in 54 children has autism in the U.S., and clinicians typically diagnose children by observing their interactions with others. And those in-person visits have been upended by the pandemic. Therapists, are you using remote video to replace a clinical visit? How is it going? Parents, how have autism services changed during the pandemic? There's still time to talk at 800-642-1234. Kristen Wegner works with children with autism as a clinical psychologist in Altoona, and she stays with us. Kristen, earlier this spring, your new children's book called Brody the Lion, Sometimes I Roar, it came out. Can you tell us about this book?
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you for asking, Kate. For the past 30 years, I have sat across a desk and worked with families and tried to support and promote awareness about autism. And I think one of the hardest things about my job is when I meet a family that thinks their child might have autism and I give the diagnosis of autism, I have seen parents cry, not because they're sad or upset, but because they knew their child was different from an early age, from 6 months, from 1 year, and nobody listened to them. And they, over and over, I have heard across the decades that parents wish there were more resources. And there are so many resources out there. There are books. There are all types of materials on the internet, but I wanted to create something that was shorter, that was in our busy, busy lives, something that was going to be able to reach both children and families and teachers. And so what my partner and I did is we created an entire children's book series. And so the first book, Sometimes I Roar, was published in April. The second book, which is titled I Can Do It, Yes I Can, is due to be published in September. And the books are going to focus each on a specific topic and work to promote awareness of not just autism but other disabilities. In Brody the Lion's first book, it is a story about his third birthday party, and in
Brody's a lion cub.
Sorry,
no,
thank you.
That's okay.
Yes. Brody the Lion is a 3-year-old cartoon character lion cub who has autism. And And so in his birthday party, he is faced with all types of events that trigger problems for many children, but especially autistic children. So he doesn't get the present he wants, his friends don't arrive on time, the singing is too loud, the friends don't want to play the same games that he had planned. And so in the book, he roars, and then his parents use a mindfulness strategy, a behavioral regulation strategy to help him calm down.
And so how does he end up in the end? Because this is a lot of turbulent things at his birthday party, and it can be turned from a really happy day to an unhappy day. What happens?
It sure can. And in the story, of course, it's wonderful, and he, at the end, is able to take his own breath without having to roar. In day-to-day life, when one of our students, one of our patients is going to have a birthday, or their sibling is going to have a birthday, we practice that event for a week or 2 weeks. We simulate birthday parties. We pretend it's my birthday. It's my coworker's birthday. And, you know, it's the bear's birthday. We practice and we sing loudly. And before the event, we practice all of the potential triggers so that we can help the child to prepare for those hopefully unexpected events that are going to happen and be able to calm our bodies down. And it's not something we just want to, oh, it's going to be a great day, because we've all been there where we, you know, think Christmas is going to be wonderful, and then it's just too much. It's overwhelming for us, for our children, and then to put in, you know, an autistic child, it can just be too much. So we want to provide that predictability. As much as you can provide predictability for an unexpected event. But the more we practice unexpected events and loud noises and disappointments and losing, and we gear ourselves up for that, we can learn to calm down. And that's the other part of the book, is at the end of each of the books is 2 to 3 pages of parent tips and techniques. And so the first page in the Sometimes I Roar book helps the parents know, how do I read this story to my child with autism, or to my child maybe with another type of need? Because the way we read a book to a child really needs to depend on that child's ability level and what they're able to understand and process.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, and then the next 2 pages go into more therapeutic techniques.
Kristen, you mentioned siblings, the siblings of children with autism. I'm wondering, how do you go about developing those relationships and those really supportive atmospheres for those siblings without putting pressure on the sibling to really be the primary protector of their brother or sister?
I don't think there's any pressure that needs to be put. I don't think I've ever met a sibling that doesn't genuinely feel that protective nature outright, that it's an amazing bond that siblings have. And I have seen, whether the sibling is older or younger, I have seen that child be able to navigate and read their sibling and know what their needs are, sometimes to the deficit, because we need our children to be able to do their own work. And so we work directly with families and work with the parent and the siblings to find out what their needs are. And then we often will even create little reward systems or token economy systems for that sibling so that they feel that they're getting something too. Because when the child with autism gets dropped off at our center, sometimes the sibling's a little wants to stay too. Can I stay and play? And so we try to include that sibling and give them tools that they can use if they want to participate, or even sometimes just a time to come in and play.
We're talking with Kristen Wegner, who has worked with young children with special needs for decades. She's a clinical psychologist in Western Wisconsin, taking your questions amid the pandemic and caring for loved ones who have autism. What have you come across as you navigate these times? What have you learned, and what services or resources have proved most helpful right now? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Kristen, How would you talk about these times with older children who are dealing with their autism? And when I say older children, you know, teens and tweens and children who are understanding what's going on around them, but still it is very, very difficult, you know, as they approach their autism and the changes that have occurred through the pandemic.
Believe it or not, for some of those older adolescents or young adults, the change was not so traumatic, because for people that struggle to navigate social situations, being at home is their element, and isolating, they feel more comfortable. And like I said earlier, we try to help people to face those anxieties and go into a social group, go to an activity. And so for some individuals, of course not all, but for some autistics, not being able to go to the football game or the basketball game or not having to deal with the social pressures was actually somewhat easier, and felt some autistics felt a little bit of ease with the shutdown.
So as almost as if they were more on an equal playing field with their peers, because those social environments that had caused stress in the past were all shut down.
Correct.
So as we go forward and you're talking with families, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about is helping your young children prepare for things, whether it's a birthday party and the elements that go along with that birthday party. How do you go about role playing and trying to anticipate what an environment will be like if there is a change in routine?
Well, first of all, we ask a lot of questions. So what did this event look like last week, last month, last year? And what were the pitfalls? And that's going to be so different for every single child. For some, it might be that it's just new people in the house that weren't there before. Some people sit in the same seats at the dinner table, and now there's different people sitting in those chairs. For other families, it might be that there's just too much noise and there's too much chaos. And so first we figure out what are the elements that are causing distress. And then we, like you said, we role play it. And so first we might do it with some stuffed animals or some baby dolls. We might use, well, we used to use a lot of our other children, but at this point now with social distancing and cutting down our numbers at the therapy center, we're using much more inanimate objects. The other thing that we've done is we bring the family in and practice. And so we had a family recently that came in, and they were going to do a pinata for a child's birthday. And so we made a pinata, and we practiced, and we set up structure so that the child could anticipate that he needs to take turns and that somebody else, and then what to do when the candy fell. So step one is figuring out what those pitfalls might be, and then how do we create a safe solution for that? Is that having a place to go to calm down if we're overstimulated? Is that being able to navigate the situation? I think there's solutions for it. It just takes so much extra preparing and planning.
Kristen Wegner works with kids and families as a clinical psychologist. Kids, do you have a brother or sister with autism? How are they doing? How are you being a good friend, a good sibling to them? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Experts say that the pandemic can be especially difficult for children and adults with autism and their families. Self-isolation and disruption of routines can be tough for everyone, but they may be emotionally upending someone with an autism spectrum disorder. How are you talking with your youngster with autism about what is going on now? Have you found support networks in the community? What stories can you share about coping? Join in at 800-642-1234. Kristen Wegner is a clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona, and she stays with us. Kristen, you mentioned earlier meeting with families who have been really distressed about not getting a diagnosis earlier, about knowing something wasn't right, but that people just weren't listening to them. When, at what point should a family receive a behavioral assessment?
Well, I'd like to say 12 months. That's the earliest that we can diagnose. It's very rare that we see children that young, but 80% of brain development occurs prior to the age of 3. And autism affects how the brain processes information. There's areas of the brain that have overconnectivity and areas that have underconnectivity. And the earlier we get a diagnosis, the better chance we have of helping that child create the neural connections that are going to help them be the most successful. Not that we want to change who an autistic child is. We're certainly not aiming to do that. But if we can help that child so they don't have a meltdown when the vacuum is turned on or the blender is turned on or they have to change their clothes, that would be an amazing thing for parents, or you know, the number of tantrums or meltdowns that happen. And so if we can get that diagnosis as early as possible, and I think for children that have more severe symptoms, those diagnoses come earlier. The children that are engaging in self-injurious behavior or aggression or are completely nonverbal, those children are typically those that get the diagnosis early. It's the children whose language, whose words develop, but maybe the nuances of those social deficits are lacking. And so the child might develop language or meet some of those developmental milestones ahead of schedule. Mm. And so other people are saying, well, oh, he's fine. He, you know, she's doing great. Look at, she likes to play. Look at how great he plays with his cars. But they're not seeing what happens when that great play is disrupted. When, and all kids don't like to be done when they're playing with their favorite toy. But when somebody, when it has to end and there's a complete meltdown and then there is this disruption and distress, that's problematic. And what I say to families is the worst thing that could happen if you go to seek a diagnosis is that you're told, no, he doesn't have autism. Because if there is autism there, we have the tools and the resources and the funding. There is, every insurance company in Wisconsin is mandated to pay for autism therapy. And Badger Care Medicaid pays for autism therapy as well. And so there are so many resources, not to mention the Birth to Three and the school districts, that have resources to be able to help children and families. And didn't mention the children's long-term support through the county. So there's so many resources that a parent shouldn't have to be worried about getting a diagnosis. And I think sometimes the label itself is what is stigmatizing. But as you said, autism is one in 54 children. It's not that much of a stigma. And we can celebrate autism. We can look at what the wonderful things autism allows a child to be able to do, some hyper-focus that can, when directed in a functional manner, can really help a child be successful in a certain area. So I think it's not something to be afraid of, but something to look at. If I get the resources early, I can help my child to navigate the challenges and also then celebrate the aspect that will help them to succeed.
We're talking with Kristen Wegner, who has worked with young children with special needs for decades now. She's a clinical psychologist, and we're looking more closely at the needs of children right now who have autism during this pandemic. With your insights, 800-642-1234. We heard from Cheryl from Wausau, called in, couldn't stay with us, but Cheryl says that she has dissociative identity disorder, and it was diagnosed late in life. Cheryl wants to know what resources might be available. A lot of people aren't diagnosed until their retirement age.
Certainly not an area of my expertise, but the mental health resources can be extremely difficult to navigate. And I think it takes perseverance And I know for autism as well, there's very few of us that do the diagnostic testing, and it can be a difficult challenge when you are ready to say, I think that I want to get some help, and then you reach out and you're turned down or there's a long waiting list. But my advice would be, if something's not right, whether it's because you're feeling anxious or you're feeling a mood disruption or you're depressed, there is help and there are resources. And just don't take no for an answer. If one person can't help you, ask for a referral and ask for another source. And we are obligated as professionals, if I can't help you, then it is my job to give you a referral to another source that might be able to. And so by linking, I might not know the answer for Cheryl, but I can link her with somebody else that hopefully does. And if that person does, they can link her with somebody else. And it's about a community and a team that when we work together can help give the resources that families and individuals need.
Kristen, I'm wondering, you know, on this journey of working in therapeutic services, the occupational therapy, the physical therapy, and working with these young people as they age and as they go through different stages of life, if it is diagnosed early, what are you seeing in terms of how therapy can help?
Right. When we start a child as early as one or two, that child often, not always, but that child will often be able to go to 4K or kindergarten without a educational diagnosis of autism, and many of our children don't even require special education services. And that's why we have the funding sources that we have, because ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis, is such a powerful behavioral therapeutic technique that the studies that started in the 1960s has shown that when this intervention, when this therapy is provided at an intensive level, children can learn to overcome those deficits that used to create such barriers, and can learn to navigate the social situations and those behavioral stressors in a way that they can be successful and not need as much support. And again, that's not the case for all autistics. That's not the case for everyone. But certainly the earlier the intervention, then the more potential success that child will have as an adolescent and then as an adult.
As we wrap up here, is there any research that you have your eye on or ways we might see autism in the future change dramatically with outcomes as the research progresses?
Well, that's a loaded question. I think the biggest buzzword lately is the neurodiversity. And there is a group of autistics that don't believe that ABA therapy that I was just talking about is the gold standard as we see it as providers. And some individuals feel that we're trying to change who an autistic person is, which good ABA, good therapy is absolutely not what we are doing. I would never want to change who a person was or the uniqueness that makes somebody special. What we want to do is to embrace that neurodiversity. And so I think we're going to continue to see a lot of research in neurodiversity and hopefully have the two sides come together to realize we are all looking at the same outcome of celebrating all of our unique differences and living in an inclusive society.
Kristen, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Kristen Wegner, a clinical psychologist. On Point is next. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.